This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I am Mark Oppenheimer, joined as ever by my co-hosts. Let's see, who do I introduce first this week? Stephanie Butnick.
Yes.
She's hosting the National Jewish Book Awards tonight. By the time you're listening to this, she is a former host of the National Jewish Book Awards.
Yes.
And
unlike the Oscars, have a host.
That's right, have a host and have books. We never talked about what a surprisingly Jew-free year this year's
That's
Oscar.
That's in my opening monologue. Do not worry.
Leah Leibowitz, you're also here today.
I am also here today.
What the heck are you doing here, man?
Hosting absolutely nothing.
Two Jews this week. Bernard-Henri Lévy, the French intellectual, writer, documentary filmmaker, wearer of crisp white shirts, who has a new book out about America's role in the world order. And Christopher Noxon, a former Jew of the Week and once again a Jew of the Week. It'll be his second time in the Jew chair. He's an author and illustrator who is a new illustrated history of the civil rights movement that's just out and belongs on your family's shelves. What's going on with you, Liel?
I'm in mourning. I really am. News of Luke Perry dying yesterday hit me harder than I can even begin to tell you. You know, you share the 90210 fascination.
I do know.
90210, as I know it was for you, was really like the seminal program of, you know, my youth. And it was shown on Israeli television at 5 p.m., I believe, on a Friday, which in of itself is like a very bizarre programming thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, just as Shabbat starts, let's welcome it in with Brandon and Brenda. And I didn't have a VCR, and we didn't have, you know, newfangled streaming anything. And so you had to rush to be home by like 4:58 p.m. on a Friday to watch the show, which I would not dare miss. And this one time, I'm 16 or maybe, you know, 15 and a half, something like this. And I run home, and it's like 4:58. It's like 2 minutes ago. I'm like, perfect. And I, you know, rush the door, you know, open the door, get into my room. And on my pillow is an envelope from the Israel Defense Forces. And I know exactly what it is. It's the envelope that tells me which units the Army is considering me to serve in, which is like the college admissions letter times right. like a million, because it's like it's a college with like guns.
Right. It's like, what's the likelihood you'll die?
It's not like Hootie and the Blowfish College. Right. It's like go to Lebanon College.
It's
right.
Like, so which sorting hat?
Exactly. Are you Gryffindor or are you Golani? Right. So
I like that you think of our college as Hootie and the Blowfish College.
In the 90s?
I actually remember the moment in McClellan Hall when I first heard my roommate Matt Salamone put on Cracked Rear View and heard Darius
there you
start
have it.
Piping it out. So
and so I look at this and I look at the little clock that is like 4:59. And here's the decision. The decision is existential, you know. Who am I? Like, am I the person who lets life bring him down? Am I the person who succumbs to like the winds of time? Or am I the person who has principles and morals and sits the fuck down and watches Beverly Hills 90210 because priorities?
Right.
What do you think I did?
Oh, I think you watched 90210.
Definitely.
There's no question.
Oh, I 100% watched 90210.
And I'll just say, you know, while I never had a sort of Army or 90210 moment, I remember when this show debuted my junior year in high school, and I was an early adopter along with every girl in my class. But the boys weren't on board yet. And I remember trying to get some of my male friends. I remember trying to get like Heffernan and Pat Kelly and dudes like that to watch
Pat
the
Kelly.
Show. Pat Kelly, varsity soccer times four to watch the show. And they were like, yeah, man, I don't know. Like it's on what network? Yeah. Fox? That's not even a real network. And that was junior year. And flash forward, summer comes, we all go off, we do our thing, you know, summer romances, beach clubs, you know, sort of 90210-ish, but New England version. And we come back in the fall, and Heffernan and Pat Kelly had both grown the Dylan McKay sideburns. I didn't say anything. I didn't sort of proclaim victory. I didn't rub it in. But I was like, well, somebody fell in love. Because remember they did summer episodes over the summer? They actually ran a season, season in the summer because they were starting to pick up steam and they didn't want to lose their fans over the summer. And they figured they'd counter program against all the reruns. But that show meant tremendous amounts to me. I used to watch it with my college roommate, Doug McKay. Not Dylan McKay, but Doug. And it's a loss. It's a huge loss, especially with the reunion coming up this summer, where they're going to do a 6-episode little arc of series with some of the other stars. So, Luke Perry. It's news of the Gentiles, but really it's news of humanity. And from one of the greats to one of the lessers, we have a few booby prizes this week in News of the Jews. I'm going to run through these pretty quickly because I don't want to sully our listeners' ears with too much of them. Obviously, we know the news about Jewish Patriots owner Robert Kraft caught in a compromised situation down in Florida.
A human sex trafficking ring. Human trafficking ring.
Yes, so. Yes.
I mean, allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly,
and
yeah.
He's not the trafficker. No. I mean, yeah, he's the
yeah,
guy
but
who...
It's like a little more serious than like a funny,
yes,
you know.
I don't mean to make light of it at all. I always thought poorly of him, and I think worse of him still. And but the only thing I feel like we as unorthodox have to add to this is he's the latest recipient of the stupid Genesis Prize.
Which make fun of it every year.
Which has also gone to who? Michael Bloomberg?
Michael Douglas. All the Michaels. Right. All the very, very wealthy Michaels.
Like, Bernie Madoff.
Yeah. If you're a soup...
Bill Cosby.
No. Basically, it's the award. No.
Recipient.
But it's the award that basically gives you $1 million, and then you like you put it to like a charity that you want. But it's like literally a award giving $1 million
to billionaires.
Billionaires.
So yeah. If you're a billionaire non-observant Jew, you get the Genesis Prize.
Famous,
right? So anyway, Robert Kraft is the latest one to get it. And the funny thing, of course, is, as we pointed out before, that on their website and in their literature, they call it the Jewish Nobel, which is like. We actually have
it. Like, yeah, it's like, guys, we got one already.
We got one already. And it's for like.
We got a lot.
It's for real accomplishment. This was also the week that many Jewish congresspersons and humans got very mad at Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar, who referred to Jews, implying that. Who on Twitter implied that Jews have allegiance to a foreign country, which was tactless and undiplomatic.
Belgium.
Monaco, actually. In England, students at Somerville College at Oxford are trying to ban kosher and halal meat because it's not stunned. And so they say it's inhumane. They say this has nothing to do with any animus toward Jews or Muslims. It just incidentally will make it impossible for them to eat anything. So it's, you know, in many ways, not the best news of the Jews this week. But... In some good news of the Jews, some of you saw the YouTube clip of the drumming Haredi bride. This is the woman
who... Yeah, that went around the internet.
That went around the internet until she asked that the clip be taken down. And now I can't find it because for modesty reasons.
Now I'm just seeing a clip art image of a set of drums. So tell us what happened.
So basically, what happened is that at a wedding in Bnei Brak, an unnamed bride who is asked that her name not be circulated around the internet because this is apparently so shameful in ultra-Orthodox circles, went up to the band at the end of her wedding party and asked if she could bang on the drums for a little bit. And video was taken. This was at the Ahuzat Wagshel Wedding Hall in Bnei Brak, the very observant area of Jerusalem. And she banged on the drums for a little while, kind of like did a little air drumming, and then...
I'd say she did way more than air drumming.
She really
actually is quite a good drummer.
But then the local Va'ad Kashrus, you know, Shomrim, you know, morality enforcers got mad, and they wrote a letter to the catering hall saying, this is very shameful. We will ask that your kosher certification be revoked and that you be shamed before the guardians of Yerushalayim and whatever, because how dare you let a woman actually like rock out on the drums. So this went all around Orthodox news services.
That's exactly how Ringo Starr got his start.
That's right. But we're here to say that whatever your name is, because your name's not being listed anywhere, we're with you. We invite you to come drum on Unorthodox.
Someone in our Facebook group pointed out, this is like a very, 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 very religious community. This is not something that most religious Jews think is acceptable. So this is like, so she was sort of hedging against this idea that we're like, oh, religious Jews are weird, which I think this story does play into. Like, a bride got up and they, you know, these crazy Orthodox people. But this was like a very, very, very sliver of the Orthodox population.
Right. Meaning her point is this is the most Orthodox.
Don't use this to then categorize.
Sure. Well, right. But it does. It crystallizes something about them, which is, I mean, she's not singing, which we know is verboten, right? Singing in front of men. She's just like banging on the drums. It's like they're pretty uptight. It just crystallizes how uptight this sliver is. Like, a girl can't bang on the drums at her own wedding.
But you know who is not uptight?
You know, every group is uptight about something.
That's true.
Do you know who is not uptight?
Who's that?
The students at Newport Beach High School.
Oh, so not uptight.
Who are so chill that at a party, there basically was a screenshot of a Snapchat or Instagram. I think it's a Snapchat of solo
cups.
We're old,
we don't know the difference.
There's a difference. A Snapchat of a solo cup a solo cup like diorama of a swastika, basically. Like,
now, solo cups are those red cups that,
that you drink beer out of, you play beer pong with. This is legitimately a massive swastika. I mean, it's like 12 cups,
it's
by
like
12 cups.
A Legoland swastika, exactly. Made out of solo cups.
And the caption on the photo says German rage cage, which is bizarre. But
what
anyway,
does that even mean?
But and in the photo, these kids have their like arms up in a Hitler salute. So
All class.
So the big problem is this is the high school that the characters in the OC went to. And so they are like really sullying Seth Cohen's alma mater. And that deeply upsets me.
Has Adam Brody come out with a statement decrying them?
He's like, actually, that's not a rage cage. So basically, the school district president said something like, you know, we have a concern both for the physical health of students who are underage drinking, as well as the mental health of our students or their friends who thought that this was an okay thing to do. They're now doing the thing where a high school gets like dragged in the national media. This is in the Washington Post, and this is, you know, a California high school. So they're basically trying to figure out what the hell happened.
I was like, oh, I'm sorry. Did we not teach you that Nazis were bad?
But, you know, it's interesting because some of the commentary on this said, as you suggested, like, what's wrong with our schools that kids don't know? You know, this is a failure of the parents and education. And I mean, in other words, let's use this as a call for more Holocaust education in the schools. And I don't feel like that's the lesson. I feel like the lesson is that these kids are
assholes.
First of all, I actually don't believe that they're all eliminationist, murderous, anti-Semites.
I believe that probably none of them are.
I believe that none of them are. Second of all, I think they might actually be getting what passes for a good education in America. I don't know that.
I should hope so at Harbor High School. I mean, that's like a really high, that's where you think the good schools are.
I mean, I think that what it's, I don't know. I just don't draw lessons from this stuff. It's horrible. And I think people do stupid, horrible things, but I don't think lessons can be drawn from what a bunch of 16-year-olds who are drunk on bad beer at a party do.
I completely agree. Although the thing that really kind of got to me about this story is like, this is a bunch of like dude bros and like eyes out shirts, like playing beer pong with like red solo cups. It made me think, like, what if, like, you know how part of the reason why we hold the Nazis as such, like, other than their horrible deeds, but it's like, it's the Nazis, fist the German accents. Imagine the same exact thing with, like, yo, bro, do you, like, totally believe in the superiority of the white race?
That's literally the tiki torches, though. Yeah. That's the scary thing.
That's Charlottesville.
Like, no, those guys.
This is not, like incel weird, like, white supremacists. This is, like, California bros. This will be, like, something else. It'll be, like, the bro-locaust. You know, these are people that hang out like, hey, man, like, should we, like, start camp and shit? Like, it's so kind of,
you find
of, like,
it less worrisome, actually?
No, I find it just so pathetic and weird, and I'm totally there with you. It's just not...
Again, we're not pro... Need we say on this Unorthodox podcast, we are not pro-Nazi.
The thing is, like, I also bet a lot of kids there are Jewish. Not in that picture, necessarily. I bet that
probably,
school.
Probably in that picture.
I bet some kids in that picture are Jewish, in fact. And they were just like, we don't want to stick out like a sore thumb.
But it's funny,
sure.
I think there's a way in Sick which we've separated Hitler and the Nazis from Jews. Like, they just are this, like a German rage cage wasn't like... anti-Semitic, like they weren't like fuck the Jews, they were like German, like they were making fun. It's like there's a way in which you're like making fun of the Nazis,
right.
Not obviously not that that is an appropriate thing to do at all, even if you were making fun of Nazis by doing it, but like they weren't, they're taking the piece, like the symbolism of the Nazi party and then like sort of divorcing it. I imagine, I don't think those kids are like, oh yeah, let's
the following students wish to apologize for their actions. Seth Cohen, Michael Goldberg.
Like Zachary Levine.
Exactly.
No, I agree with you, Stefan. I see exactly what you're saying, which is there's a way in which now it's like we're mocking this weird bit of German history and not we're imitating people who kill Jews.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. But I think the question is, what's the aftermath? When they wake up the next morning and they play some Fortnite and they sober up and have some—
And they vape.
And they check the news. Their parents check the news.
Are they mortified and do they go to their friend Zachary Levine and Michael Cohen and say, dude,
but here's the thing.
Sorry.
I think I disagree with you about education. I think that if they did like I think that if they did it right, a really interesting thing about like how the Germans actually weren't just like funny fascists. They actually were like you there's an angle of which
Germans,
that isn't
just
showing
just
you the pictures
fascists.
Of the Jews in the camps. Like, it isn't just showing you the images that are sort of seared in your brain from the one intro course you had to take.
That might be right. And that might be what, you know, the sort of Prince Harry problem is like when the Nazi uniform becomes like another funny thing you can do for Halloween, we stop thinking of it as imitating the people who killed
We think of it as imitating Prince Harry. Our Jewish guest returning to see us for the second time is writer and illustrator Christopher Noxon. His new book is called Good Trouble, Lessons from the Civil Rights Playbook, and it's an illustrated history of the civil rights movement. Chris, welcome back to the show.
I am so glad to be here.
Thank you for writing this book so you could come back to hang out with us.
That's pretty much why I write them. It's true.
It gets them on our podcast.
It's just an excuse to hang out with you guys.
Because last time you were on the show was July 2016, which was quite literally a different world.
It really was. Yeah, and a lot happened.
And a lot happened that actually sparked the idea for this book, right?
Totally. I was writing a book and had finished a manuscript about converting to Judaism called Prick, which is on a shelf.
A book, by the way, we're still waiting for.
I'm eager to do it. But I gave it to my agent. I was like, all right, let's go out to publishers and whatever. And then I was on a book tour for the novel not long after I was here.
A novel that I love.
It's called Plus One.
Yes. One of the funniest, most charming novels.
That's super sweet.
I love Plus One.
But, it's about householding men and breadwinning women and Los Angeles. And it's a sort of light comic, sociology. And it's a family novel. And I was in Memphis on a book tour. And it was 2 days after the election of Trump. And I was kind of devastated and kind of freaked out, like everybody. And I was supposed to go to Graceland. Because it was Memphis, right? And that's what you do.
That's what one does.
But I woke up that morning and I was like, you know what? I really don't want to go gawk at fabulous 70s interiors today. That didn't feel like the move. And I heard there was a great civil rights museum there. So I took a lift downtown and I got out of the car at the address and I walked over and there was no museum. It was like a old hotel. And I got closer and I was like, where am I? What's going on? And I saw a wreath hanging from one of the banisters. And I was like, oh, shit, this is the spot. And I didn't realize that they built the museum inside the facade of the Lorraine. And I just lost it.
Where Martin Luther King was shot.
Was assassinated. And I just lost it. I think I had one of those. I think all of us had moments in the days after that event where we sort of faced the reality of it.
Curled up and cried for a while.
Yeah, I curled up and cried on the streets of Memphis at 11 o'clock on a Wednesday morning and then went inside. And that story, it felt at that moment like it had everything to say that I needed to hear, both sort of morally and tactically. And I spent 2 weeks, I carry around a little journal and I wrote my last book longhand and I started drawing while I was writing my last book and I've been drawing a lot more. And so I just started drawing mugshots, the images of those faces of people that were, in the sit-ins and on the freedom rides. And
because in the museum, they have their mugshots.
They have giant,
activists being arrested.
Correct. Right? And they're young and old and black and white. But there's this clarity and resolve and sort of direction that I was like, I want that.
The book, which is absolutely gorgeous, consists of lessons from the civil rights era and how the people there achieved, the tremendous victories that they did. How did you distill those? How did you take this immense, complicated story and sort of choose the, 10 kind of lessons that you have in the book?
I just talked to people. I spent about 6 months holed up in Harlem at the Schoenberg Center, and I just read as much as I possibly could and just got sort of educated. And then I went down to the South and I, talked to people who were in Selma and Montgomery and Birmingham. And I managed to talk to John Lewis and to Andrew Young and to some of the leaders and then some of the foot soldiers. And I asked everyone that I talked to, what do you think worked and what didn't work and what can we apply today? And a lot of the sort of presumptions that we have about the movement that we learned in school are just utterly false.
So give us a couple, what are some real misconceptions that I have to save my children from?
Well, the first one is and I sort of fell victim to it while writing the book, which is you think of it as this Martin Luther King march from Montgomery to Memphis, 1955 around the Brown Act, till 68 when he's killed. And just the idea that there's this kind of narrative. And, halfway through my research, when I was talking to people, I'd be like, so let's talk about 1955. And they're like, no, let's talk about 1614 when the first, slave ships arrived in Jamestown. And let's talk about the Civil War. And let's talk about Black Lives Matter. And let's talk about so the time frame of civil rights is a lot broader than we're commonly sort of pigeonhole it in. And the idea that it's just this kind of secularized political movement, where when you talk to a lot of the people that were involved, it was a faith movement. This was, it grew out of the Black Church And it was mostly run by church women who were really leading the leaders. I mean, Martin Luther King was playing catch up for the ladies and the students. So it was women and students who were totally driving this thing. And the ministers who were sort of trying to scramble to keep up with their like activist popular uprising that was, you know, sort of brewing within their midst. So there's a lot of just sort of really urgent, relevant information about how this thing worked.
So the book talks about the way spirituality was such a big part, this undergirding part of the civil rights movement. Could you tell us what you mean when you say soul force?
Yeah, I mean, that's the translation for this Hindu word, Sayagartha. But basically, it's Gandhi's idea of this kind of overriding, connecting, beloved community. And it animated the Indian independence movement. And, you know, Bayard Rustin, who studied with Gandhi's people before going to Montgomery and basically educating Martin Luther King about nonviolence, taught him that. And, you know, Bayard Rustin, who was this Quaker, queer, lute-playing, conscientious objector who was older than almost everyone involved, got Martin Luther King to give away his guns and basically renounce violence and self-defense in that way. And the overriding principle of this soul force was just like, we are all part of this interrelated web. And this is not a war. This is not us versus them. And this part of it just feels so important right now. Which
you're
is
saying
like,
soul force beats space force any day.
Any day. Yeah. Any day.
So my favorite line in the book is casting matters. And you're talking about the fact that, you know, there were people before Rosa Parks who had refused to give up their seats. And frankly, there were people who didn't want them out front because one of them was a 15-year-old unwed mother and one of them had a criminal record and so forth and so on. And Rosa Parks was like a respectable middle class woman. She was kind of perfect from central casting. And you do say, like, regrettable as it is, casting matters.
Yeah, it's kind of uncomfortable to think of like these godly social movements having these people behind the scenes going, okay, who's going to be the best person? Like, how is she going to photograph? Is she light skinned enough? These were things that were actually considered. But it, you know, and also on the flip side, I did learn that when they decided to go into Selma for the voter registration drive, they did that in part because they knew that there was this guy there, Jim Clark, who was a total hothead, who was going to overreact, and it was going to be the perfect foil. Yeah. They cast him in that part.
Knowing that they would all be...
Knowing that he was going to come at them...
Brutalized.
They would be brutalized, and that they would absorb those blows.
And that part of it is... I mean...
You know who knows this message really super fucking well? I would say that's Trump, right?
He casts his foils.
Doesn't he work supremely well? Are you seeing so? And this is my lead into the bigger question. By now, these amazing lessons that you recount in the book, they sort of go both ways, right? I mean, this is enough common knowledge in our culture to sort of play on all sides. I mean, if you're talking about something like casting, well, two could play that game. Is it time for a completely new paradigm of activism that actually doesn't draw from the civil rights? Is it possible that we're so enamored with that amazing, uplifting era that we're kind of missing the point of now and here?
Maybe. I mean, I definitely feel like there's so many lessons here that we've forgotten that could work.
Right.
And I think, you know, Trump may be looking at the civil rights playbook, but I don't really think he is. I think he's looking at George Wallace's playbook.
But now that you've illustrated it, he might look at it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. This will end up on his bedside table.
I'm always amazed at how well-dressed the civil rights marchers are. They wanted to say in their you know, proper ladies' attire and in their coats and ties and jackets, they wanted to shame America by looking more American than thou. They were going to say, we're the respectable ones.
They're Sunday best.
They're Sunday best. Mm-hmm. Do we need more Sunday best on the left?
100%. I bought myself a suit. A really nice one that I got arrested in at the U.S. Capitol last summer protesting the healthcare, the dismantling of Obamacare. And I was like the best dressed guy among a bunch of like, you know,
cell.
Hippies and stuff. In
Casting
the cell. Casting
matters.
Christopher Noxon voted best dressed in cell G. No,
I think that is so important.
Me
I really
too.
Do.
Well, I mean, you're sitting here in a tie. And
I just think like, you know, nobody wants to, you know, don't make the left scruffy.
Yeah.
Don't make activism like smelly and... wearing like hemp drug
rugs.
Oh my God.
And those suits at that time were so freaking sharp.
So sharp.
I mean, ridiculous.
The dark skin, the thin lapels.
Oh my God. It was such a good look. You can't really say this now. I actually had written something about that and I was like, you know what? That just seems a little trivial.
The civil rights fashion book.
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be great, man. It's not, though. It's like, it's actually super
meaningful. We're going to publish it in tandem with the guide to Hasidic sects, according to their strimals.
I've always thought the Hasid teenagers look the coolest.
Gorgeous.
I mean, when you're a 13-year-old kid and you're floppy and you don't know what to do with your arms, if you've got acne, if you've got a fedora and a pretty good suit, it's
speaking
solved.
Of 13-year-old boys, can we talk about your son Oscar's bar mitzvah?
Aw, why?
It was a Jews Your Own Adventure party.
It was a Jews Your Own Adventure
How
party.
How are we not going to talk about that?
all my kids had very, very different kinds of services, and he was being very resistant towards, you know, choosing a theme. Not that he needed a theme, but
he's like, the theme would be Judaism.
And we talked about him getting up and, yeah, exactly. We got him talking about getting up and sort of leading a service and talking to people in the audience about things that were important to them. And it sort of came out and grew out organically that he wanted to have the service change according to what everybody wanted. And I was like, it's like a choose your own adventure book. And he was like, a Jews your own adventure. So I got super nerdy and went on Photoshop and made a choose your own adventure cover with his face. And we had, and that was the whole
thing. And so how did it go? What did people choose?
There, we chose the prayers, which ones we were going to do. There was one point where we decided if we wanted to do a reggae or a bluegrass version of one of the prayers. We had a band that was ready to do one or the other. There were topics that we veered from and to.
And literally, like, the audience got to
put their hands up, and
that
then
is
we
amazing.
Just said,
the congregants.
Man, I moved to LA. That's how you roll out there.
That's right.
You've got the band that it can go bluegrass. It can go klezmer.
What are we
doing? I have to say, all credit to this group called Storytelling, which does these sort of tailor-made.
Amazing.
Yeah.
They do the Labshul. They do Labshul High Holidays. Yeah. I love that.
Todd Schatz, baby. Look him up.
Chris Noxon, I want to say, I think you have Soul Force.
Oh,
Satyagraha. Satyagraha?
We'll find the Hebrew translation as well.
Yeah.
And we are so grateful, as always, to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Where can we get your book? Where can we find out more about you?
Oh, you should get on my Instagram, which is at NoxonPix, NoxonPix. And I have a website, ChristopherNoxon.com.
And I will say that you should buy his book because all proceeds are being donated to the Center for Popular Democracy, a nonprofit advocacy group that is devoted to racial justice, healthcare, and poverty issues. Yep. So you're not even making money off this.
Zero.
Christopher Noxon, author, illustrator, and mensch.
Friend of the show.
Second time Jew of the Week, Christopher Noxon. Our next guest is the French intellectual and swashbuckling documentary filmmaker Bernard-Henri Lévy, who periodically comes to the United States to hawk one of his several dozen books. And we are really privileged to have him in here to talk about his latest, which is called The Empire and the Five Kings, America's Abdication and the Fate of the World.
Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Happy to be here, too.
So your book, which is terrific, the premise is sort of there in the subtitle, that America has abdicated its traditional leadership role in the world. And you painstakingly, intellectually explain the sort of geopolitical essence of how this happened. But reading this book, I couldn't help but pick up almost a theological strand, that you weren't talking just about political moves. You're talking really also about this idea that Barack Obama and Donald Trump alike had forgone this concept of American exceptionalism, of divine election. Why is that?
You are right to say that it is, on this regard, Obama and Trump alike. And by the way, I think that, if I may say, if you authorize me, one speaks too much about Donald Trump in America. it's too much of the conversation.
Even you're sick of it.
I'm sick of it. Americans are sick of it. I'm sure that the people of the listener of tablets who will hear for us are sick of it.
Absolutely.
Donald Trump is an epiphenomenon of a much bigger phenomenon, an undercurrent phenomenon, which is the withdrawal of America from Europe, from the rest of the world, and from its own DNA, from its own essence. America, USA, were built on some values, on some principles, on a metaphysical project, which I identify in my book, and I think that the breach and even the break is with this metaphysical project. And Trump, of course, He tweets like the last king of Roma, Romulus Augustule, who was tweeting in proper sense. When you read when the life of the 12 Caesars of Sueton, you see the Donald Trump of the time, Romulus Augustus, Romulus, the name of the founder of Rome, Augustulus, which is the little August. He was with his chickens. Tweeting, and this is what Sueton says, like Trump, the last king of Roma, and maybe, I hope not, the last president of America, tweeting with his chicken, pot, 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 like this. We are in this stage.
So as the latest in a long strand of French visitors who come here to help us make sense of ourselves, what happened to us? Why is this happening? And most importantly, what ought we to do to stop it?
You stop, read Virgil. You, maybe not you, but
us. The American people
has stopped to read Virgil. The founding fathers of America were readers of Virgil. 19th century read Virgil. John Fitzgerald Kennedy read Virgil. Maybe not in Latin, but why Virgil? Because Virgil tells the story of some good-willing people leaving a city in flames, which was at this time Troy, and rebuilding this city in a new ground, which was at this time Roma. The founding fathers of America had the belief that they were in the same position, leaving city in flames, which were Amsterdam, Paris, London, and so on, making a long journey by ship to a new ground, which took them not to Roma, but to New England, and they built America. America was built on this project, to resume Europe, to resume the West, to continue the Western adventure, for the worst, but also and mostly for the best. America was constructed on this Virgilian idea that there was a continuous building of the West on the values of the West, which were tolerance, freedom, free spirit, and so on, and that each time it failed in Troy, then in Roma, or it had to be rebuilt further. What happens in America is that this link of light, this link of life, this link of spirit between Europe and America, let's say it concretely like this, is being broken nowadays. That's what I mean when I say that what happens, it's a metaphor, it's like a joke, but not completely, is that you stop reading Virgil.
So this book is about America and how things are like not super great here. Also in France, right? Like it's hard to hear. Like things aren't so great in France either, right?
In France, it is also terrible. We are, honestly, this book draws the map of the geopolitical world of today, of the historic situation where we are. We are the world, entire world, America, Europe, the West, and the rest, in a more than critical situation. To say it in one word, we are living the third big crisis of democracy, liberal values in Europe in a little more than one century. The first one was before World War I, first crisis, Dreyfus Affair and so on. All the European people had the belief that democracy was dead. Second crisis, the 30s, 20s and the 30s of the 20th century. America first in the 30s, neutrality, and in France, okay, democracy is done. We loved it, but it is finished. You know how it ended? It ended with the biggest disaster in history. We are now facing the third crisis of democracy, of liberal values, and of European values. This is the stake. And my hope, my certitude, my certainty, but my hope is that the outcome is not the same. That we will be able this time to solve the crisis together. The West, with our partners and our friends, democratic friends out of the West, without reaching such a disaster at the two first times.
Monsieur Lévy, thank you for being our Jew of the Week. It has been wonderful to have you here. Is there anything...
And what's the worst Americanized pronunciation of your name that you've heard?
Bernie Henry.
Yeah.
Bernie Henry Levi.
Levi, I like that.
We shall not commit such sins.
I committed it myself.
Okay. But
Bernie,
because
Bernie,
of you.
Bernie, thank you for being here.
And the book is The Empire,
and the Five Kings.
And the Five Kings, now available in hardcover for your library. That was Les Trois Juifs, the three Jews sitting down with a fourth Jew, Le Quatrième Juif, Bernard-Henri Lévy, a few weeks ago at Argo Studios.
Tell me, in the day or the night, would it kill you to call or write?
To the mailbox. We got lots and lots of feedback about the circumcision episode. If you haven't heard it yet, go back and listen to it, but enjoy these responses. Stephanie, what do you have for us?
This is a great one. Hello, Unorthodox. When my son was circumcised last month, the moil used a special board to restrain him during the procedure. I noticed the label on the restraint board, letting me know it has a name. It is called a circumstraint. Better mothers would be worried about someone cutting their son. Better Jews would be more into the importance of the occasion. I was just trying really, really, really hard not to laugh out loud. A circumstraint? Keep up the good work, Jenny Rothschild.
Oh, my Lord.
That's insane.
If you have made or marketed the circumstraint, please call us, because you're a troubled person and we want to talk to you.
Liel, would you share with us a letter responding to the circumcision episode?
Hello, Jew crew. I just finished listening to the circumcision episode. I'm disappointed that you didn't have anyone on the show to speak about alternatives to Brit Milah, i.e. Brit Shalom, that is practiced in some circles. I would have loved to learn more about this quote-unquote unorthodox tradition, and maybe even a first-hand account of parents who chose this way to complete the covenant. Thank you, Ricky Ofek. Well, wouldn't be quite the covenant without the covenantal part, would it now?
But still, I think the point of doing one circumcision episode is that then we can do another one where we, you know, like
yeah,
I love
I
the
agree.
Idea that there are so many things. We can only capture so much in, what, like a 90-minute episode.
We should do another one that we would never listen to.
Right. No, I think there's a room for next year.
And people who have, like people who've done alternatives, you know, have put an orange on the Sandek palette or whatever, should write into us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com and say, you know, for the next circumcision episode. Like we'll go anywhere. Stephanie, what else do we have?
Hi, thanks for an episode that was really cutting edge. There's one interesting tradition that no one mentioned, giving the kvater or kvaterin honor to people who are trying to get pregnant. On that account, we are two for two. A good friend who had one child but who was thinking of building her family was the kvaterin for our older son's bris. Her husband had signed our ketubah, but it took a few years until we had a role for her. 9 months later, they welcomed a baby boy. Before our second son's bris, I learned that another friend had been dealing with fertility problems for years. I asked her if she would be willing to accept this honor, knowing that it might be hard for her to tend, but explaining that it is a special role for someone trying to conceive. At that point, no medical or spiritual option was off the table for her and her husband. And, lo and behold, 9 months later, they also welcomed a baby boy. Yours, Jordana Schmeier.
So
if you're trying to get
pregnant,
I had
not heard of that.
Here's what you do. You get a boy. An eight. This is like one of these great superstition things. You get an 8-day-old baby. You hold him down real tight.
This is like our version of throwing the bouquet.
Yeah,
the quadrant person like carries the kid into the room, right?
So,
but that's amazing. Two for two.
Really,
so
there we go.
Amen.
To the voicemail.
Aloha to the Unorthodox team. This is a fan of your podcast. I live on the Big Island of Hawaii, and I have no skin. To borrow Stephanie's joke in the circumcision game, would you guys please do a podcast on choosing not to have children? I would love that. I have known since the age of 6 that I did not want to procreate. My husband had the same feeling. And what I'm noticing is that our choice not to have a child is probably a bigger deal than my marrying a non-Jewish born and bred German.
There's so many amazing things about this message, but the one thing that I love most is like the tropical birds in the background.
Yes.
Like, sure, we would do an episode about not having kids if we had the good sense of like moving to Hawaii and
we'll
living in paradise.
We'll come to Hawaii, be the happiest we've ever made. No, I think it's super interesting because think about all these these like mitzvahs that relate to having children. And basically now that a lot of people are choosing not to have kids, are not able to have kids, like the world is totally different. And the realm of the breadth of Jewish experience looks so different than it did a generation or two ago. It would be fascinating.
You know, I think we should. We've done an episode on infertility or people having difficulty having children, different paths to motherhood or parenthood.
But this listener is asking about choosing.
And I had two reactions. One was Stephanie's reaction, which was, of course we should do that. It's a not uncommon experience, and we want to reflect all of our listeners' experiences.
Live from her home in Hawaii.
In Hawaii, right, with the birds chirping, the toucans in the background. I want to come clean about something, though, which is, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's not my own experience that I nevertheless feel I can sort of relate to. So, for example, infertility. Like, thank God we've had a number of children, but we've also lost pregnancies, right? I feel like I've had a taste of it while nothing like what some people have, thank God. You know, wanting to have only one child. Yeah, I could see if we were stuck with just Rebecca, there'd be upsides to that. wanting to make a lot of money instead of being a journalist. It's not my path, but yeah, I could see. There's many things that aren't my path, but I can see it. Not even wanting to have children, I have no ability to relate to that. I've always thought that having children is something I'd want.
Can I tell you something?
I simply can't.
So that's why we need an episode of that.
I am 100% there with you.
I can't even fathom it. And that's no not connection. Disrespecting. It's like.
Okay, so, but there are. Yeah. Then there's no, all the more reason.
All
to
the more reason to have an episode.
Examine something that you don't understand.
I will learn something from that. And I'm excited. I'm excited to do it. To another voicemail.
This is about the circumcision episode, which I found fascinating, and I wanted to report my own case of circumcision by proxy. Being a hippie earth mother type back in the day, I was relieved to give birth at home to two girls, so luckily I didn't have to ambivalate about what was to me the agonizing question of circumcision. My brother, on the other hand, experienced no such conflict. "No son of mine is going to have a bigger schlong than I have," he exclaimed. He was, of course, a psychiatrist. At my nephew's bris, I experienced overwhelming empathy for the screaming infant. He was wailing while the cruel, spectating adults around him guffawed. I rushed out of there, off to the salon where, in gender-crossing solidarity, I had my waist-length hair chopped off. Love to you all from your fan, Marcia Ian, in Bellingham, Washington. Bye-bye. Shalom.
Possibly the greatest voicemail we've ever received.
Ever.
Everything about this is amazing.
The only question I have is, have you told your nephew what you did for him? That you were rocking the waist-length hair, and in solidarity with his loss of foreskin, you got shorn.
Listening to her, she probably did, like, at his wedding.
I just think Jews are the best people, except for all the other people. That's all I have to say about that. And finally, a last voicemail of the week.
I just listened to the circumcision episode, and I have to say this really hit home with me. I had a very similar story to one of the women. I just had this sensation of panic where this child is perfect. He's God's creation. And who am I to do this to him? Why would I make him suffer like that? At the morning of the bris, I was panicked. I was nauseous. I was really freaking out. And my sister-in-law, who's, you know, modern Orthodox observant, just sort of took me by the shoulders and said, "Hey, you're doing this. This is happening. He's not Jewish unless you do this. That's just it, you know, that's the covenant." And I said, "Okay, fine, but this is totally barbaric," and I freaked out. But in the end, he was fine. After a week, I made my husband do all the changing of the diaper because I just couldn't handle it. And by the time my third child was born, who was also a son, it was really no big deal.
I just want to say I like that creative solution to the panic, which is, "Okay, hubby, the diaper changes are on you for the first few weeks." And I think that that may have been the case with me. I don't really remember because those first few weeks of David are such a blur, but I feel like I did an enormous amount of the diaper changing.
It's in the Bible.
It's in the
Bible. Abraham changeth Isaac, and Isaac changeth Jacob.
If you have mail or voicemail for us, you can send your mail to unorthodox@tabletmag.com, or you can VM us at 914-570-4869. That's 914-570-4869. Stephanie has a live event coming up. Tell us about it, Ms. Butnick.
I host the Jewish Book Council's Unpacking the Book series at the Jewish Museum. It's really fun. I sit down with authors, talk about their books. And the next event is March 28th, and you guys can be there. We're talking to Nathan Englander about his new book, Kaddish.com. We're talking to Rebecca Sofer, who's been on the show. She's the co-author of the book, Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief, Beginner's Welcome. And the event is titled, What We Talk About When We Talk About Loss. And we'll be just talking about grief, mourning, Jewish rituals, and the way that fits into our modern world. You guys can find more information on the Jewish Museum website. It's free, and you get admission to the museum included with your RSVP. So RSVP online at the Jewish Museum, and I hope to see you there.
Mazel tovs. Leo, do you have a mazel tov?
I do.
What is it?
My mazel tov is to an amazing brand I discovered this week. It's called Rebbe's Choice. It is a brand of herring. Each herring is inspired by a different Hasidic master. First of all, the boxes come with little, very insightful, like surprisingly in-depth, insightful little shears or lessons about the Rebbe. Second of all, the herring is like the best herring I've ever had. I was eating it at the table and my kids are like, ooh, herring, let us have a bite. And then they ate it and like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Who was it named after, this box. One?
The rabbi of Lilov. It was with jalapenos and capers. It's
I can't
amazing.
Even imagine a product more specifically marketed to you.
To me. And by the way, there's a Zusha themed one, right? My favorite Hasidic master, which is herring in za'atar. This is like,
that
literally
actually sounds amazing, but
someone created it for me.
We need them to be advertising on the show.
And catering.
Or we can just advertise for them on this show.
or catering every single recording with their delicious herring.
I'm
so
with
thank
your,
you guys.
Hashtag I'm with Lillian Hudson. Anti-herring.
I'm using my mazel tov to make a little personnel announcement. We're really excited that Sarah Fredman-Ader is joining our team as an associate producer. And we just really like her. She's been on the show. You heard her last week on the circumcision episode. She's a friend of the show, a listener. And now she will be working with us. And we're really excited.
Yay.
And the flip side of that is that our beloved producer, Shira Talushkin, is moving on. She's going to still stay at Tablet and doing a bunch of other stuff. She works on the Parsha podcast, which you guys should be listening to. We're so sad to lose her, but we're not really losing her because she'll still be around all the time and we love her and we're just excited for her and just so thankful for her years of work on this show.
Yeah.
And
transitions are bittersweet. We're so excited for Sarah, but
we're very fortunate to have both of them.
Yes, absolutely. And in Sarah's honor, we're all taking her maiden name as our middle name.
We're all Fredmans now.
That's right.
We're all Fredmans.
Stephanie Fredman Butnick, Liel Fredman Leibowitz, Mark Fredman Oppenheimer. I never liked my middle name much anyways. I'm happy to cashier Edward for Fredman, which actually seems like a kind of more chill Edward.
Mark Fredman Oppenheimer.
Mark Fredman
I really
Oppenheimer.
Wish I had a middle name.
I know. We did this once, but I think we should really
What should be my middle
give
name?
Give Liel a middle name. Actually, this is a great idea. It's March, which means it's March Madness. So I think our listeners should send in their ideas for Liel's middle name. We just need, 16 to
we
start.
We'll do a bracket?
We'll do a bracket.
We do a bracket.
And then we'll do it on Instagram, on Facebook. You will be able to vote on the ones, and then by the end, it'll be between Duke and whatever the other name is.
By the name
and
that you will choose for me. This is how much I love you.
This is amazing. Okay, so email our producer, Jay Cross. He is across the glass right now, excitedly saying that he'll put together a bracket. So jcross@tabletmag.com, subject line, Liel's middle name.
And you will call me by your name. Middle name could be Timothée Chalamet Leibovitze.
Army Amer. My mazel tov this week is to my friend from synagogue, Carol Koenig, who it's a thank you more than a mazel tov. Her beloved husband, Dr. Bob Oakes, beloved local pediatrician, died a couple years ago, and she said to me recently, "Would you like his sweater vests?" Aww. And I said, "Why, yes, I would." And I said, "Was he size medium?" And she said, I think he was. And she invited me over to her house a couple blocks from where I live. And she brought down these beautiful sweaters. Some were sweaters, full-length sweaters. Some were sweater vests. She said, "You know, he lived in these." And I said, "I know he did. I remember. He was a sweater vest guy." And she just put this pile down. And she said, "Take whichever ones you want." And a couple of them were kind of a dark red that I already have. And I didn't take those. But then I got a few, including this beautiful navy blue Brooks Brothers 42 chest sweater vest that I'm wearing, and it's just so meaningful to me. First of all, it's a lovely gesture, and second, I'm honored to be wearing Bob Oakes's sweater vest. He was a giant of a man, and he was a gentle giant. He was a giant of a man and a gentle man, and I miss him, and I'm just glad. I'm glad to be honored by his sweater vest. So thank you,
Dr. Oakes. Your legacy lives on.
Unorthodox brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. You can ask for our newsletter by writing to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. We come to you live from time to time. To book us or advertise with our show, email producer Josh Cross, that's Cross with a K, at jcross@tabletmag.com. You should wear and carry Unorthodox too. Friends or enemies need Unorthodox swag. Go to bit.ly/unorthoshirt and find the latest in shirts, mugs, and onesies with our branding on them. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on Twitter. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Josh Cross, and our associate producers are Sarah Fredman-Ader and Noah Levinson. Our editor is Sophia Steinert-Evoy. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our social media intern is Elazar Abrams. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Jeffrey Sirkman of Larchmont, New York. We come to you from Argo Studios, which uses 8 braids to make a challah. Shalom, friends.